Good afternoon. My name is Greg Chambers, and I represent the petitioners at the appellants in this case. The primary issue on appeal is the legal effect of a conversation that occurred between the dying physician, Dr. Stieg, and Dr. Miller, the medical director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. At the time, while Dr. Stieg was providing an impairment rating for the claimant, in this case, Mr. Miller. If I may, I'll give a little bit of background. Mr. Miller, not to be confused with Dr. Miller, but Mr. Miller, the claimant, had...
Or Judge Miller. I don't believe I'm related to either one of these people.
And isn't there a sitcom called The Millers out there?
I think so.
Mr. Miller had a shoulder surgery as a result of a work-related injury. At the time that he reached maximum medical improvement, he was entitled to an impairment rating consistent with the AMA guidelines, third edition revised. In that guideline, under section 3.1J, the guides provide in pertinent part the following. Derangements not previously described can contribute to impairments of the upper extremity and should be considered in the final impairment determination. This section then gives a list of specific disorders to be considered, and then it goes on to state the following. This is one of the important areas. It must be stressed that impairments secondary to these disorders are usually rated by other parameters. The following disorders that are listed should only be rated when other factors have not been adequately related, or not adequately rated the extent of impairment rate. Now, neither Dr. Stieg, the dying physician in this case, or the evaluating physicians, both Dr. Olson, who was our expert, and Dr. Swarson, who was Mr. Miller's expert, have read the provision to mean that a claimant automatically gets an impairment rating, a 10% impairment rating, simply because he has a shoulder surgery. Now, the Division of Workers' Compensation, DOWC, has created impairment rating tips that has been on the record established that articulates the DOWC's position on impairment issues. The tip of shoulder surgeries reference section 3.1J of the guidelines. The tip stated that if additional impairment rating is deemed appropriate, it should not be more than 10%. And again, neither Dr. Stieg or the evaluating physicians interpret this tip to read that a claimant automatically gets an impairment rating simply because he had a shoulder surgery. More background. Dr. Stieg, in his initial report dated December 6, 2011, provided Mr. Miller a 10% impairment rating based on the fact that he had a shoulder surgery. We took his deposition. Dr. Stieg. In his deposition, Dr. Stieg gave the opinion that Mr. Miller had an excellent recovery following surgery, had no permanent restrictions following surgery, and had minimal, if any, functional limitations. And importantly, in fact, in his deposition, Dr. Stieg specifically stated that the loss of range of motion clearly reflected Mr. Miller's true impairments. Now, please note that the administrative law judge, in her order, she made the following finding of fact. This is on finding of fact number 30, page 611 of the record. Dr. Stieg implicitly determined that claimant's range of motion loss did not adequately establish the extent of claimant's left shoulder impairment. Quite the contrary, Dr. Stieg explicitly testified to the exact opposite of this finding. So why did Dr. Stieg initially provide the additional impairment rating of 10% in his report? Petitioners submit it is based solely on a telephone conference that he had with Dr. Miller. According to Dr. Stieg, although Dr. Stieg was questioning whether Mr. Miller was entitled to an impairment rating for the shoulder surgery alone, Dr. Miller told Dr. Stieg, that having a surgery carries with it a 10% impairment rating. And that's important because the instructions Dr. Miller gave was clearly wrong. As I already talked about, the DOWC's position on whether a claimant receives an impairment rating for a shoulder surgery automatically is not true. The DOWC's position is that a claimant can get an impairment rating if loss of range of motion does not adequately reflect the full true impairment. In his deposition, Dr. Stig made it clear that before he even called Dr. Miller, he was confused about whether he should be given this impairment rating for the fact that Mr. Miller had this shoulder surgery. If Dr. Miller had provided Dr. Stig the correct instruction, being, you have the discretion, Dr. Stig, to give or not give an impairment rating based on the fact that Mr. Miller had a shoulder surgery, there's no doubt that Dr. Stig would not have given the additional 10% impairment. He made that clear in his deposition.
Well, apparently there was some doubt because the ALJ didn't draw that conclusion, and the panel agreed with the ALJ that there was evidence to support Dr. Steve's conclusion that he was looking at other factors.
And I ask you to look at the deposition. It's not that long, but the key finding of fact that the judge made was, as I articulated, that Dr. Stig implicitly made a determination that claimant's loss of range of motion did not adequately address his overall true impairment. That was her finding of fact. If you look at her order, that's the only finding of fact that's relevant to this particular appeal.
Well, Mr. Chambers, correct me if I'm wrong. What didn't Dr. Stig also talk about the rating tip language, that if deemed appropriate, and he was relying on that language as well?
He said no, and that I want to be clear. There is nothing in the record that establishes that Dr. Stig relied upon the impairment rating tips. If you look at and I know this is like we're arguing the facts, and I apologize, but this really gets to why did he give that impairment rating? And we believe it's because Dr. Miller told him that he should. He was instructed to do so. So, to answer your question, no, there's no evidence in the record that Dr. Stig relied upon the impairment rating tips. If you look at his deposition, that's where it all is. It's not in his order. If you look at his deposition, he never says he relied on the impairment rating tips. That was a finding made by the judge that we challenge because Dr. Stig never said he relied on the impairment rating tips. We presented him a copy of the impairment rating tips. He looked at it. He said, yes, I agree. This tip says, if deemed appropriate, I can give an impairment rating. And then he goes on to say, if it was up to me, if I'm just relying solely on the AMA guidelines, I would not have given him a 10%. He goes on to say that it is the instruction I got from Dr. Miller that I was supposed to give an impairment rating based solely on the fact that Mr. Miller had a shoulder surgery. If you look at it again, Dr. Stig says full recovery, has no permanent restrictions, has no, very little, any functional limitation as a result of this surgery, has minimal loss of range of motion. He says that. Then he goes on to say, looking at that, yeah, I think that the impairment rating for loss of range of motion adequately addresses, okay, he said clearly, represents the true impairment of this gentleman. And then says, if I'm looking just at the AMA guidance, I wouldn't have given me an impairment rating. Well, why did you do that? And judge, or a doctor, and he says, because Dr. Miller said that the DOWC position is, if you have a shoulder surgery, you get a 10%. It carries a 10% impairment rating. No discretion. It's mandated. That's what, if you read the transcript, that's what it says. So I know that we're talking about findings of fact, but we're also talking about if substantial evidence supports those findings of fact. And there's got to be some evidence in there. But when you have a judge that says the implicit determination of the dying position is that loss of range of motion did not adequately address the true impairment rating, and you look at Dr. Stig's deposition transcript, and he says exactly the opposite, Then you got to wonder, does any evidence support this finding?
Well, Mr. Chambers, let me ask you about that. One of the things the panel said was that Dr. Steeg realized that given the nature of Mr. Miller's impairment, that he was likely to have further pain in the future, and that that was a factor that he considered.
That was a factor that was asked in terms of the context of whether the gentleman would need maintenance care in the future. It wasn't a finding that the ALJ made to say, Dr. Steeg, when you have a little bit of evidence over here that says A, but you have the doctor in his deposition saying, but clearly B, you got to say, is that substantial evidence? You got to say, what is making him make this, what is making him give this impairment rating?
Well,
and you think, I'm sorry.
If there's a little bit of evidence one way and a lot of evidence the other way, is it within the province of the ALJ to rely on the little evidence one way?
Not if the ultimate opinion given by the doctor is the loss of range of motion clearly reflects his overall true impairment.
Didn't Dr.
Swanson
also testify that the 10% impairment rating was appropriate?
Yes, Dr. Swanson did.
So isn't that evidence?
Well, that is evidence as a 10%, but the evidence, I'm trying to get at and what we'll get to eventually is why did Dr. Steeg give an impairment rating? We're looking at what Dr. Steeg did or did not do based on the information that he had at the time that he was doing the impairment rating. So Dr. Steeg calls Dr. Miller, which we believe is in violation of section 8-42.
And I don't, that doesn't make sense to me. Let me just ask. The section you're talking about prohibits a contact with the authorized treating physician, and Dr. Miller was an authorized treating physician.
Correct.
Or any examining or reviewing physician. She was not an examining or reviewing physician.
I'm not sure what that language means. And the problem is two things. No case laws interpret that particular provision, as far as I can tell, in reviewing the published decisions from the Court of Appeals or the ICAP decisions.
Well, what would be the argument that she was an examining or reviewing physician?
Reviewing physician is where we would probably hang our hat on, because she is the medical director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. We think the petitioner's position is that this definition of reviewing physician to affect legislative purpose should have a broad interpretation. The legislative purpose behind this is to require the dying physician to use independent medical judgment when providing an impairment rating devoid of any outside influence.
Is there any evidence that she even knew who the claimant was?
There's no evidence.
How could she be an examining, reviewing physician if she didn't know who the claimant was?
Because reviewing physician is a term that I don't know what it means. And I don't have any guidance from the Court of Appeals for making this. I imagine this will be the argument of first impression. We raised that argument in front of the Administrative Law Judge and the Industrial Claim Appeals Office, that Dr. Miller was, or Dr. Steeg violated this particular statutory provision. They did not specifically address that issue that we raised on appeal. Rather, what they seem to suggest that this was harmless error.
Mr. Chambers, I forgot to ask you if you wanted to reserve time for rebuttal, and you have about a minute and 20 seconds left.
You know what? Yeah, I'll reserve time, so I'll stop now.
Okay.
I'll let Dr. counsel take over. Thank you.
Thank you.
Members of the panel, counsel. I want to address this section.
Excuse me, could you identify yourself for the record, please? Thank you.
My name is Neil O'Toole. I represent Mr. Miller, and I have been here before and should have known better. And at any rate, Section 8-42-101-3.6N is the statute that counsel was relying on, I think, in the first section of his brief where he's talking about issues on review. I can see nowhere where that statute is in any way impugned by the conduct of Dr. Miller here. I want to remind the court that, of course, the statute itself, the Act, has extensive sections dealing with medical issues. Of import here is section 8-42101 3.6N. And what that is the appointment of the director. And it basically says, the director of the Division of Work Comp shall contract with the medical school, University of Chicago, for the services of medical director, to advise the director on issues of, and then this medical director happens to be Dr. Miller that we were talking about. Accreditation, impairment ratings, guidelines, medical treatment guidelines, etc. With regard to her role in this case, she is the one that helps individuals who have accreditation, who are subjected to or have questions about the IME process. The rules of the Division of Work Comp, specifically Rule 11-2K, as in Kennedy, says in order to assure fair and unbiased IMEs, the dying doctor shall not engage in communication with any person other than the division staff. She's a member of the division, and she properly responded to the questions of Dr. Steve. Now, I am confused. Excuse me.
Mr. O'Toole, what is your response to Mr. Chambers' argument that even if we assume that Dr. Miller was able to properly provide advice to Dr. Steve, that the advice that she gave was mistaken or incorrect?
Well, she makes the rules, and the legislature says she makes the rules, and the director approves the rules, such as the rating tips. And we keep talking about a revision arthroscopy here, but it was a distal clavicle resection. That's exactly what it was. The reality was she said that those circumstances could give rise to that. And it was clear from his statement that and his testimony that he realized it wasn't mandated that he give the 10%. But he said, I go back to the guides. I look at the guides. And the guides say to me, does this rating by range of motion alone adequately evaluate the level of this man's impairment? And I disagree with Mr. Chambers when he says he did not think about functional loss, because that's precisely what he was talking about when he recognized that this man, because of the nature of his work, was likely to suffer in the future and as a result of what was going on, from dampness, weather changes, stretching, reaching, pushing. And he documented at the time he saw him deltoid numbness and acromioclavicular problems. And he said, very simply, I made up my mind. The bottom line, if you have a distal clavicle resection, you give 10%. And it's not the same as a regular surgery, which is precisely, as I understood the argument of Mr. Chambers when we were going through this process. So he came across the totality of information that he had. One, he knew about the rating tips. He was trained. He said, I had been to a course in recent past, and was this had been discussed. Am I understanding that this is the division's position with regard to the application of the AMA guides to evaluation of permanent impairment, third edition revised? He says yes. And he then has that conversation and then comes to the conclusion that it's not mandated that he gives it, but he feels that it's mandated at the time. Dr. Swarson agrees that based on the record that existed right then, that it was number one proper to contact Dr. Miller to confirm that this was continued to be the position of the division. I should tell you that over the years, reading tips have been modified and they have changed and they focused on different body parts. But this particular tip had really been pretty consistent. And number two, that it was appropriate to provide a 10% rating for this man's distal clavicle resection.
Mr. O'Toole, let me ask you this. Your understanding of the record is that the doctor exercised his independent judgment, did it because he deemed it appropriate, and didn't do it automatically because it was mandated.
That is
correct. Had the record shown that he just did it because it was mandated, he automatically had to do it, but he didn't personally believe he ought to have, would that have been an error?
Addressing that relevant counterfactual situation, I would say to you, probably not, that the dime doctor would have made his decision thinking that it could have been mandated. But if it wasn't mandated, and you reach the same conclusion because there's other independent medical testimony on that issue, it doesn't seem to change the nature of the determination of the dime doctor. Of the ALJ, which was that there was adequate evidence to render that opinion. Now, if there was a better record, I always get caught saying, what if? But in this case, there is no if. I mean, I think of a little story, and I wasn't going to develop it, but I have a cousin, married a guy, and his father was Kelly Kellogg, and he talks about, he was a referee in the Big Ten. I don't know if you knew Kelly or heard him. He was like 5'3". And in the Big Ten at the time, they had Wilkes Chamberlain. And what happened at one game, Wilkes Chamberlain walked up to him and said, "Ref, are you reffing in the same game I'm playing in?" And the reason I bring it up is I think that Mr. Chambers was not playing in the same game I was playing in, because I believe we have more than adequate evidence to support Dr. Steve's opinion. And it was a reasoned opinion, which he actually had to struggle with. And he came to the conclusion that he was right, and he gave that and stuck with it. And he could easily have changed his mind at that deposition, but he didn't. Well, I had nothing for
Mr. Chamberlain. Wilt Chamberlain played in the Big Eight, so maybe they weren't.
It was the Big Eight. It was the Big Eight. It was the Big Eight because he was playing for Kansas, and you are correct. But Kelly, the story is subject to modification, but it is a story as it has been related to me. And the conferences show my evident lack of recollection with regards to the conference of their composition.
From 60 years ago.
I have nothing for you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Toole.
How do I follow that? All right. So, and again, and this goes to your concerns. It's in the record. This is his testimony, Dr. Steve. The opinion is clearly range of motion reflects Mr. Miller's true impairment, as it demonstrates excellent recovery from his surgery, demonstrating minimal, if any, functional limitation. I agree. He says that in his deposition.
Mr. Chambers, if I can ask you a quick question.
Go ahead.
I don't think you covered this in your brief, but Dr. Steve was a dime doctor, so that means that the review of his decision his opinion has to be overcome by clear and convincing evidence.
Correct.
And so what is your response to how that standard affects our review?
At this point, we're on appeal. So the question is not so much, I'm not disagreeing with the burden of proof, but we're on appeal. And the question is, was there a violation of the particular statutory provision when Dr. Steig contacted Dr. Miller? Second is, was it harmless error? And I would say to you, it's not, because Dr. Steig three times, says, if it was up to me, I would not have given them 10%. And Dr. Miller told me that the DOWC position is very clearly, if you have shoulder surgery, you get 10%.
So I see your time has expired.
Yeah, it is, and I think Mr. O'Toole and I explained different conferences.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chambers and Mr. O'Toole. We appreciate your arguments this afternoon, as well as your discussion of the height of referees and basketball players, which may no doubt inform our decision this afternoon.
You can take judicial notes of that.
The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes.